Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. We've all seen apocalypse movies in which an asteroid hits the Earth or a virus wipes us all out. But what would happen if a couple of thousand of us survived? How would we be able to rebuild our world from scratch if this was for real? Unless you're a doomsday prepper, you have a lot of problems. Now, Lewis Dartnell gives us the solutions of survival in his exciting new book, The Knowledge. Forget the iPhones and supermarkets. We be going back to the basic agriculture, compasses, and wheelbarrows. After the grace period of subsistence of what's already here dies out, we will have to revamp everything in our lives, including the food we eat, the medicines we take, and the way we move and communicate. Far from a boring thought experiment, Dartnell's book is a survival guide that very well might rivet you and get you to think. In this day and age, anything can happen. Lewis, welcome. So first, let me thank you for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. Your book is definitely makes everyone scratch their head. And it's both something that's on people's mind and also the inconceivable. So let me jump into my first question. What is actually an apocalypse event?
Oh, so the knowledge, what I take as the starting point for the thought experiment behind the knowledge is some kind of apocalypse event, some kind of doomsday. And all I really mean by that is an end to the world as we know it. So some kind of collapse of civilization, some kind of, you know, disassembly of this support structure and kind of infrastructure that supports all of our everyday lives. Let's imagine that were to all collapse and disappear tomorrow, and there'd be some kind of mass depopulation event along the same lines. So I don't really specify in the beginning of the book exactly what the apocalypse was, because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter when you're trying to understand what it takes to reconstruct a civilization from the ground up.
But Lewis, does it not really matter? Meaning, isn't there a difference between, let's say, a world war and a virus gone mad?
So if civilizations collapse and lots of people have died, there are certain scientific knowledge and technological capability that you're going to need regardless. And that's what the book is about. The book is about these behind-the-scenes fundamentals of how a civilization actually works, that the stuff that you don't see that happens behind the scenes. But of course, if you find yourself in this kind of post-apocalyptic environment, you're one of the survivors, then your scenario will be different depending on exactly what happened last year or a decade ago, whenever it was, civilization collapsed. And so if you find yourself after a nuclear war, you're going to have a much, much bigger challenge. It's going to be much more difficult to restart than, for example, if there'd been some kind of pandemic virus that killed off the people but left the cities intact and, you know, hadn't poisoned the ground with radioactivity. So if you're a survivor, there will be differences in the scenario, the details of the scenario you find yourself in, but you're still going to need exactly the same knowledge to try to recover civilization from scratch.
So, Lewis, before I extract that knowledge out of you, let me ask you a question. Do you think we're going to actually have this event?
I don't, no. So I'm a scientist. I'm a research scientist at the University of Leicester. And I say this knowledge, the book, is a thought experiment about how our world works, you know, the world that we live in. What's the kind of behind-the-scenes fundamentals? And if you needed to, in this hypothetical scenario, if you needed to, how could you go about accelerating history, avoiding a dark ages, and rebooting civilization as quickly as you possibly can. So I use the apocalypse as a starting point, as a kind of narrative conceit.
So I actually love that idea. So let's start off. What would be the first thing people would do? Leave the city, stay in the city? How would we reboot society?
So the very first things you need to do in the first kind of days and weeks and months after this event, whatever it was, is I would argue you probably want to get out of the cities. The cities, you know, for starters, are going to be, kind of breeding grounds for a whole number of different diseases, because unpleasantly and unfortunately, probably be a lot of bodies lying around. So get yourself away from the cities. And if the grid goes down, if there's no electricity and the water pressure starts failing in the pipes and the gas supply goes down, cities, modern cities, will basically be uninhabitable. You won't be able to support yourself there with all the ground tarmacked over and covered in parking lots and roads. You want to get out into a more rural setting, get away from the cities, find yourself where there's some nice fertile ground where you can start making the beginnings of agriculture and starting to grow food for yourself again. Probably find yourself, you know, near a wood where you can use the timber for reconstruction or for firewood. But you probably want to stay close enough to cities to spend in, you know, scavenging trips or go foraging for the kind of things you need to scavenge and repurpose and start rebuilding. Things like metals, you'll want to start scavenging from these dead, abandoned cities.
What would be the hardest and what would be the easiest thing to do? Number one, you know, how would people get to fresh water if they're not surrounded by it?
So, I mean, unless you find yourself in the middle of a desert, there will be sources of water around. You might be near a lake or near a river or something. In the same way that human habitations throughout history have always kind of found themselves to a reliable natural source of water. But what you do want to make absolutely certain is that the water you're drinking is not contaminated or infected with waterborne diseases. And what you should hopefully be able to do just by possessing the right scientific knowledge that I talk about in the book is leapfrog over centuries of history and avoid, for example, outbreaks of typhoid and cholera and all of these transmissible diseases, because you can do simple things like purifying water for yourself. And you can use, for example, kitchen bleach. You can dilute that to disinfect water, or even swimming pool chlorine you can use to disinfect water. Or even something as simple as an empty plastic bottle, that there's a process that's recommended by the World Health Organization, or the WHO, the developing world, for disinfecting water. And all you do is just fill up an empty plastic bottle with water and then leave it in the sun. And the ultraviolet radiation, the UV rays from the sun, will sterilize and kill any bugs, any germs that are in that water.
So that's kind of
when you come back in it.
I said, that's quite interesting. So all you're
really
doing is drinking warm water, but at least it's not infected.
Exactly. So throughout this book, I try to provide like really simple rules of thumb, things that were not known or weren't appreciated throughout history that could save you an enormous amount of trouble and time as you're trying to rebuild. And these are simple things like, how can you make certain your drinking water isn't going to kill you with some waterborne disease? And then as you look back forward through time over, you know, the decades and generations as you rebuild the civilization for yourself, how can you start doing more complex things? You know, how can you start making steel for yourself? How can you start trying to reinvent antibiotics?
So tell me what the answer to that is. How would you start making steel or antibiotics?
So what I talk about for antibiotics, once you appreciate this idea of germ theory, which is the notion that the reason people get sick and pass disease from one person to another isn't because of some fractious god sending a plague upon humanity. It's because of things which are so small that you can't see them with your eye, but they get inside your body and they make you ill. And that's what a germ is. And if you appreciate that very simple fact, and I explain in the book how you can build a very, very simple microscope that will show you germs and you can therefore prove that they exist. And once you understand that, you'll appreciate why things like purifying your drinking water are important and why sewer systems are important so you don't infect the water in the first place. But looking down the line to things like antibiotics, I explain the very kind of simple experiments that you can set up that were transformative in your own history for how you can stumble once again across these molds and bacteria that create antibiotics that can kill germs for you and another bacteria. And so this is, you know, the kind of Alexander Fleming type discovery. And rather than relying on chance and a serendipitous discovery like Alexander Fleming did, what would be the experiment you would instruct or hint at someone to do for themselves so that they rediscover antibiotics as quickly as possible?
Lewis, is there a better kind of apocalypse than a different kind? Obviously, the nuclear war would be worse, but what would be the best one?
So if you are a survivor and you get to choose which apocalypse you have to survive and recover from and rebuild a civilization afterwards, you get kind of a menu, if you like. Do not tick nuclear war. It would be awful to try to recover from. Don't tick asteroid strike or comet strike. Those are going to be incredibly devastating to the planet as a whole. And actually, the best way for the world to end, at least from the point of view of people that survive it and have to recover afterwards, would be something like this global pandemic plague or virus or something, because that would kill the people, but leave all of the stuff left behind. Cities would have a lot of resources and materials and things you can scavenge and keep your, you know, your society going, coasting on the momentum of the dead civilization for as long as possible.
Have you done research, Lewis, on what type of personality would it take for people to survive, and how would they deal with the grief of those they lost? Was there any research done on that?
I did speak to people about exactly this, and about the kind of, you know, the resilience of the human spirit, and people who survived, you know, airplane crashes into the middle of nowhere or other kinds of natural disasters. And all of this is a really fascinating area. And clearly, you're going to need some kind of mental fortitude and resourcefulness and teamwork and cooperation. And you're going to need someone with leadership skills and the kind of vision to steer your society from after the apocalypse. But the knowledge doesn't really dwell on these things. At the end of the day, the knowledge is a popular science book. So it talks about the science you need, and it doesn't really talk much about systems of government or systems of economics or philosophy or religion. All of those things are clearly important for societies, but the knowledge is a science book, so it focuses on the science and technology you need to build a civilization.
And so let's go back to the science. Obviously, people need to be warm, they need to be sheltered, they need heat. Now, what happens if they're a Brooklyn Jew who doesn't know how to do anything, like screw a nail in the wall like myself? How would I survive?
Well, I mean, this is where the kind of cooperation comes into. And I think one of the kind of key points behind the knowledge is that not really any of us in a modern society, in the developed world today, no one really has any of these skills anymore. You know, they're important. Two generations ago, our kind of great-grandparents were much more self-reliant, and they grew their own food, and they made their own clothes, and they repaired things. And no one really does that anymore. If your mobile phone, if your smartphone breaks, you chuck it away, and you just go and get a new one. And there's been this loss of capability. You know, our entire society has become consumers rather than producers or tinkerers. And it'd be good to kind of appreciate a bit of that, I think, after reading the book. That's certainly what I've taken away from it, and just be a bit more conscious and, I guess, appreciative of all these things that society does for us, and therefore what you'd have to relearn for yourself if it were to all disappear. But, you know, if the apocalypse were to happen tomorrow, and I hope it doesn't, I don't think it will, but if it were to happen tomorrow, we're going to have to pull together as a community of survivors and, you know, each take on a different niche or a different role within society. And
what skills would be the most important, and which would be the least important?
So clearly things like having some basic first aid knowledge, or being good with your hands if you're a carpenter or a metal worker. You know, all these things will be very, very important after the apocalypse. And perhaps being good with marketing or advertising perhaps would be less important after the apocalypse. But, you know, everyone's got more than one skill. Everyone's got different attributes and things they can bring to the table. So I wouldn't for a second want to see that anyone would be useless.
Do you now, as a scientist, would you say that when tragedy happens, people tend to more bond together to try to survive?
So I think there's kind of two sides to the coin. If you have a collapse of society, a kind of a deconstruction of law and order, you will get violence. You will get people being mean to each other and looting and stealing. And, you know, there might be a surge in the number of murders when people are looking after for themselves and knowing that they're not going to get caught and prosecuted and thrown in jail because the police force doesn't exist anymore. There are no more law courts. But I think, and I think I'm very fair in saying this, that on the whole, humanity is good, and we're cooperative, and we're social, and we do look out for each other. So although there will be an element of lawlessness and crime, I think on the whole, people pull together. And as I say, looking at similar localized examples, when there's been an airplane crash in the Andes, the survivors pull together. When there's a natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina, there was lawlessness, but on the whole, people pulled together, people looking out for their neighbors, helping people along, sharing what they had with people who needed it. And I think this same, you know, community spirit will hold strong and hold true through the apocalypse, and people will band together and then rebuild societies and let's say kind of progress from there.
Lewis, what kind of apocalypse have you looked at as a scientist? Have you looked at viral, bacterial, have you looked at nuclear, meaning, and what would happen to the animals in an apocalyptic? the situation?
So again, it depends exactly on what kind of events happened. If there was some kind of nuclear war, then humanity would suffer great deal. A lot of people would be killed, but also a lot of our animals around us would be killed, and anything kind of near the cities that were hit by the nuclear warheads would suffer. If it's something like a viral pandemic, viruses are incredibly specific to the species that they infect and end up killing. So if most of humanity were to be wiped out by some kind of pandemic, some kind of viral pandemic, you know, the cattle would still be behind, the pigs and the sheep would still be here, the wildlife and the birds would still be behind, which is why the survivors, who may have luckily not been exposed to the virus or maybe had some kind of natural immunity, they would find it a much easier prospect to recover afterwards because the animals are still around. They've still got farmyard animals and things they can use. But in my own research, within astrobiology and the kind of threats that might impact entire planets, entire ecosystems, I look at things like supernova, which are exploding stars, or kind of mass solar flares from suns. And these are all possibilities, but, you know, just very unlikely, that they're not the kind of thing that would be the most likely cause for an apocalypse on the Earth.
What would happen if the entire electronic grid and the internet went down? Would that be considered apocalyptic?
So if an apocalypse happened and a lot of people died, then the internet would fall down, would disappear as soon as the power grid goes down. Because at the end of the day, although the internet was invented, you know, to link together nodes of cities and a military network and survive a first strike nuclear attack, the internet today in the World Wide Web is as dependent on the servers being powered by electricity as anything else in our modern society. So the internet would evaporate just as soon as the power grid went down.
And then I'm saying is, if the internet went down and the power grid went down, but the people remained intact, what would happen?
So one cause that might create that scenario would be something called a coronal mass ejection, or CME, from the sun. And this is essentially a great big solar burp that the sun sends out, this violent, vast cloud of charged particles. And when it hits the Earth's magnetic field, it sets it ringing like a bell and ends up short-circuiting entire power grids. It blows out the transformers. And something like this happened back in the year 1859, in what was known as the Carrington event, in a world that was essentially still pre-electrical, that there were kind of telegraph wires, but there wasn't like power distribution grids in the way there are today. And if that same event that happened in 1859 would happen in today's world, it could possibly knock over power grids across enormous regions of the Earth. So imagine what might happen, you know, if the United States or the United Kingdom were to suddenly lose electricity for days, weeks, if not even months. I wouldn't like to predict what might happen, but it could get very serious indeed once, you know, food stops being transported to supermarkets or fuel no longer gets processed and refined and delivered to gas stations. And it might be the kind of event that could then cause a collapse of society. People would stop going to work. People would stop looking out for each other. There might be riots and then kind of food grabs and looting. And that kind of thing could lead to collapse of civilization and a great loss of life afterwards.
Now, as a society, in your research, what would be the method of trade? Would we go back to the bartering system, or would there be some sort of currency that would still maintain its value?
Well, it would depend on how far things regressed before you could catch yourself and then start bootstrapping, start pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps and progressing forward again. But clearly things like credit cards would have no meaning once the power goes down, the internet collapses and banks don't exist anymore. But things would still have innate value. Things like a can of food would still be very valuable to someone, and you could trade for that. Things like condoms, people are still going to want to have sex after the apocalypse, but not put themselves at risk of, you know, STIs or pregnancies. So things would have inherent value after the apocalypse to what people need for their day-to-day lives, and those could become items of trade. But in terms of building a complex society and moving forward again, you're going to want to get back to a kind of a monetary system where it's not swapping cans of food for each other, but having like a unit of currency, like a coin, and then moving up to more complex economies. But as I say, I kind of only brush over these ideas in the knowledge. I don't really deal too closely with currencies and economics.
How would one keep farmland fertile? How do you start actually planting for someone who doesn't know what they're doing?
So right now, the modern agricultural system is based on artificial fertilizers, putting nitrates back into the soil for productive plant growth, and the extensive use of things like artificial pesticides and insecticides. And after the apocalypse, you'd be able to scavenge some of those for the time being until they basically ran out. And you've now got to answer yourself the question, as you say, how do we keep our farmland productive if we can't make artificial fertilizers for ourselves? Because those are really difficult to make from scratch. And I do deal with it in the kind of advanced chemistry chapter, but that's pretty advanced technology to be able to get back to you. But you can use simpler systems, as we have used throughout history. And the notion of crop rotations is one I talk about in the agriculture chapter. And things like legumes, which are pea plants or soy or alfalfa, these are the kind of plant that when they grow, and because they've got bacteria living in their root systems, they put nitrates, fertility essentially, back into the soil. So if you alternate back and forth between something like a legume crop and then something like wheat or oats or barley, you can keep your soil as fertile as you can over the years as you recover, and then start trying to redevelop things like the harbor process that supports basically a third of humanity alive today because of this piece of industrial chemistry called the harbor process. But it'll be very hard to get back there quickly.
If there was an apocalypse, let's say it was a viral one, what was the first thing that you would do and you would have your family do?
So I suppose, me personally, it depends where I was when things started falling apart and everyone got very sick. Cause I think that the first natural response would be for us to go and find our loved ones, try and get back to our family and make sure they're safe. And then perhaps to try to hunker down, try to kind of, you know, close yourself off at home, avoid contamination, yourself getting infected as best you can. But I wouldn't classify myself as a prepper. I'm not really preparing for any kind of end of the world. I don't have more than about 2 days worth of food in my tiny kitchen in my flat in North London. So if this scenario were to happen, I'd say I'd probably be in as a bad situation as anyone else in the country who's not kind of been preparing for a particular apocalypse. And my interest in this situation, as I said, was the starting point of a thought experiment about how the world works and how you could rebuild it from scratch if you ever needed to. Just by
This is a little fascinating because in the 1800s we had a burp that the sun let out and there was no more electricity, even though we didn't have electrical grids. That's only a couple of hundred years away. Why couldn't that happen again?
Sorry, do you mean with the Carrington event? With the
yes,
exactly. So that's why people have a genuine concern for events like the coronal mass ejection or the Carrington event. But they seem to be rare events, that they don't seem to happen more often than every couple of hundred years. So there are hazards that are facing our society right now that we know are happening. And these are things like release of carbon dioxide and global warming and ocean acidification. These are genuine real threats that are already happening. And I think it's important to focus on solving those problems rather than worrying about things that are very rare and might not happen for a long period of time. But of course, it's appropriate to be conscious of these other risks.
Do you think that scientists have a greater chance of surviving than the average person?
Well, I think science will be important for recovering a society over the long term, and that's what I talk about in the knowledge. But in the immediate aftermath, as I say, I think it comes down to what kind of community you can build around yourself and how you can mutually support each other and take care of each other, and having practical skills like knowing how to farm or knowing how to build things as a carpenter or as a metal worker or being a mechanic and knowing how to keep car engines running or how to process biofuels for yourself. Those are all going to be very important skills.
So wouldn't it make sense for everyone to be some sort of a prepper? I mean, you only have 2 days worth of food. I don't even have 1 day worth of food in my house. Unless I count my dog food, which costs more than my food.
I think I think the point you're making is a very good one. I think all of us would benefit and be enriched by the process of being aware of how things are made and how they're done. And that's something I've tried to address in the book. And I think people get a lot of enjoyment out of learning how to cook or learning how to grow their own food or doing a woodworking course or a pottery course. Or there's a whole movement of people who do kind of hacking or crafting or making. And I think that kind of movement back to doing things for yourself and seeing how things work, it is a really good movement. And it's kind of going against this general trend that I mentioned earlier about society in the developed world. It's basically become one of consuming rather than producing or making for yourself.
I have to tell you, Lewis, I think that's the best message coming out of the book is that as we become more and more technologically dependent, you know, we lose our basic skills, and maybe we should go back and balance our basic skills for survival along with technology.
I think you're absolutely right. And when I was researching this book, I made sure I did get some experience and some skills and expertise in doing things and making things. And I found it enormously satisfying. And it's that kind of, you know, sense of empowerment and self-capability that I think anyone today would benefit from, regardless of whether there's an apocalypse coming or not, which as I said, I don't think there is. But for me, the take-home message from the book is it's not about the apocalypse at all. It's a take-home message of optimism and empowerment and finding out how you can do things for yourself. And if you wanted to, you could genuinely follow some of the instructions in the book and make soap for yourself or make your own paper or do some of the chemistry.
So let's have our audience understand a few things. Tell everyone how to make soap and how to make paper.
So, and again, this is chemistry that's been important for centuries, for hundreds and hundreds of years through history. And the basic chemistry that you need to know is how to make alkalis, which is the opposite of acids. And alkalis do a lot of very useful chemistry for you. And for example, if you react fat or oil, so you can get it from an animal fat or you can get it from olive oil or any other kind of plant, you can convert that fat or oil into soap by reacting it with an alkali. And the easiest way to extract alkali for yourself from the natural world is to either burn some wood or burn seaweed and then trickle water through the ashes. And potash from wood or soda ash from seaweed will be dissolved into that water and kind of soaked out of the ashes, and so you've extracted it. You've done some very, very basic chemistry to extract a useful chemical for yourself, a substance which is an alkali. And if you then react that soda with fat oil, you can create soap for yourself. And again, soap, something we just take for granted. It's a boring substance. But imagine what the world would be like if you couldn't wash your hands and you couldn't stop the transmission of diseases every time you make food, every time you've gone to the toilet. You know, it's something that is we just take for granted because it's so readily available today, but is really, really important to have if you were to lose.
I think there's some advertising firm right now thinking of making an International Soap Day.
I think it would be useful. And again, the kind of statistics that I talk about when I was writing the knowledge, again, the WHO, the World Health Organization, and these international development agencies around the world, they say that you could prevent up to a third of all of these infectious diseases in Africa and Asia and developing world if people simply wash their hands. If people had access to soap and wash their hands regularly, you wouldn't get so many, you know, wouldn't keep catching diarrhea off yourself or off each other. And in the developing world, people don't die. So in the developed world, in the US and Europe, people don't die of diarrhea. You take a day off work and you're fine. But it kills, you know, millions and millions of people, even today. So imagine if you're surviving this apocalypse, this hypothetical scenario, something as simple as knowing how to make your own soap and break that cycle of infection is going to be fundamentally important. And the same kind of chemistry behind making soap is behind making paper.
So tell me how to make paper, so this way everyone could write their last will and testament.
or just kind of note things down, or to start trying to accumulate knowledge again by writing things down. And the key chemistry here is called hydrolysis. Hydrolysis is when you break down complex molecules into simpler ones. You break down fats to make the soap, or you break down all the cellulose and the lignin that are the complex molecules that make up wood in a tree. And you break apart those chemical bonds from wood, and you get like a soup of short little fibers, and you turn that kind of pulpy mess.
Well, first tell me, how do you break it down?
So to make the alkali you need for paper making, you extract potash, or even better, soda ash, as we've already said, from the ashes of a wood fire or a fire of seaweed. You take that soda, and then you react it with quicklime. And you can make quicklime, again, very, very easily, by digging up some chalk or some limestone, and you roast it in a kiln, in a hot oven, and you break that limestone down to quicklime. And if you mix the quicklime, mix it with a bit of water, and then you react that with your soda, you create a very, very potent alkali. And you can use that to make soap, we can use it to make paper. And you react that alkali with the kind of wood chips that you've broken down, and it breaks down the chemical bonds in the wood to release all the fibers. So you've now got this kind of pulpy mess, as I say, of fibers floating around in a kind of soup of wood fiber.
Now, Lewis, isn't it true that McDonald's hamburgers would still survive?
Is what true, sir?
If there was an apocalypse, wouldn't McDonald's hamburgers still survive with all the chemicals put into the meat?
Would hamburgers survive?
McDonald's hamburgers in particular.
I don't recognize that. I assume that.
Fast food. Would you find that fast food that's already treated with chemicals would have a greater chance of surviving than food that's more natural?
So what I have heard is that Twinkie bars will essentially never go off. And I did look into that, and it turns out to be not true. So that's an urban myth. And basically any food will go off eventually. Things like fresh fruit and veg will go off within a few days or weeks. Like I say, kind of canned food will be preserved much longer. And processed food often does have preservatives added. So, you know, a loaf of bread you buy from the supermarket will last longer than some fresh bread you bought from the baker where they added no preservatives or additives. But everything, all food will go off eventually. And this is where you get the grace period from. After the fall of civilization, you get to scavenge in the deserted supermarkets for a period of time before the food runs out or has gone off. And you have to, by that point, you have to know how to grow food for yourself. Otherwise, you starve to death and have a famine, and it wasn't worth surviving the apocalypse in the first place.
Lewis, as a scientist, what makes people even want to survive an apocalypse?
Well, again, I think there's no kind of real good answer to that. I think humanity is, and any species, it's got this kind of sense of self-preservation. Otherwise, we would have not survived until now. So humanity's got this drive within it, this force for trying to survive and self-preservation. And alongside that, I think humanity's innately, like I said, a social species, a cooperative species. We've only achieved all of these marvelous things that we've achieved today in our modern technological civilization because people have worked together rather than fighting against each other. We've got that natural spirit, I think. But also I think humanity is a very, very curious and inquisitive species. And that's where science comes in. People wonder about these things we find in the natural world and try to understand them. And it might be, you know, your first explanations might be talking about the thunder gods which arrive when a storm happens. But over time, you investigate the world, you find things out, you use science to create theories that explain the natural world around us. And one of the offshoots of science, particularly in the modern world, is technology that makes your life easier, allows you to do things more quickly or more efficiently. And it's through that process of science and technology that the kind of civilization progresses and you move forward.
But isn't science in some ways self-defeating? Because what's happening with the advent of the advance of technology, aren't we in fact making the majority of people stupider and stupider and more dependent upon everything else rather than ourselves?
Well, I mean, I don't know about people getting more stupid over time. I think the standard of education in the developed world is leaps and bounds what you would have found 50 years ago or 100 years ago. But undeniably, people are becoming more dependent on the civilization we've built. Because we don't grow our own food anymore, we don't make our own clothes, we don't repair things, because someone else in our civilization does it for us much more effectively. But on the other hand, we have much more specialized and niche jobs. And at any point in civilization, at any point in society, you need your populace to be able to perform the roles that are required by that society. So 200 years ago, you needed a far higher fraction of people working in the fields as farmers than we do today. And the reason that you don't have 50, 60, 70% of your entire population breaking their backs, working with a hoe and a plow to farm the land, is because we've applied our knowledge and our intelligence to create tools to do things more effectively for us and create new fertilizers and improved crops so we can grow far more food with far fewer people working in the fields.
Now, and, I found something that you said very fascinating, Lewis, that you said that the Industrial Revolution was not based on knowledge but a particular socioeconomic environment. Explain that.
So the Industrial Revolution and the invention of these earliest the machinery of things like the steam engine and the train that was built with it and kind of steam pumps and things. And also there were advances around that time, Industrial Revolution, in smelting iron and in producing steel and kind of mass producing things like this. Those are things that people remember about the Industrial Revolution. It was the smoke and the steam and the roar of engines and smelting of steel. And of course there's the application of knowledge and understanding and being able to do that. But it's fair to say that the first steam engine wasn't really built by science or by the application of theory. The first steam engines were created by people who had, you know, kind of intuitive sense of things. They were kind of tinkerers and engineers who just tried something to see if it would work, realized what was not working very well, improved it a bit through trial and error, and the first steam engines were created. And only then did people work with those steam engines and try to apply science to improve them and make them more efficient. But it wasn't really a scientific baby, if you like, in the first place. But even more fundamental than that, the reason that the Industrial Revolution happened in Britain rather than anywhere else in the world, in the kind of late 1700s, early 1800s, rather than any other time in history, wasn't really a scientific reason. It was a social reason. And this comes down to kind of the culture that was around in Britain at the time, an economic situation and a social situation, and the fact that there was money to be made by making production more efficient by using machines, particularly with making clothes for the textiles industry. You could make more money by doing it more efficiently by getting machines to do it rather than having people do it and paying them a wage.
Now, Lewis, you mentioned that doctors would become almost slaves in such an apocalyptic society. Why is that?
Oh, so the idea here is that, and again, I was more kind of a hat tip to the kind of post-apocalyptic films we've all seen in the cinema, like, The Road or Mad Max and stuff. But if there were to be this collapse of society and the evaporation of law and order, there's going to be a lot of violence, there's going to be kind of mobs running around, there'll be kind of bandits. And if you do find yourself in a situation before things start settling down again and people start banding together, if you do have special skills, it was almost a throwaway line in the book. I was saying that maybe if you were a nurse or a doctor, you might want to keep that to yourself because those skills would be very valuable to people after the apocalypse and they might essentially, kind of take you hostage or make a kind of a very specialized slave of you. If they're needing your medical knowledge or your first aid knowledge, they might kind of force you to do that against your will. But as I say, all of this would kind of happen in the first weeks and months. And I would believe, and I've got reason to be optimistic about this, I think, that society would settle down again, as it has done again and again throughout history, and people cooperate and start progressing.
Lewis, as a scientist, do you believe that there was human life on other planets?
So I do. So my research fellowship at the University of Leicester is in astrobiology and the search for life beyond Earth. So looking to Mars and what environmental conditions there, bacterial life, simple life might be able to survive, and what kind of experiments or tests we would do to look for the signs of life, to look for so-called biosignatures. So I'm working on a probe at the moment called ExoMars that will launch in the year 2018 to Mars. This is a European Space Agency mission, and I'll launch to Mars looking for signs of life in the Martian dust. So that's my actual science.
Do you think that we are the highest example of evolution as human beings, or do you think that there are species in the cosmos that make us look as dumb as a roach?
so certainly within our solar system, certainly within the planets and moons that share our sun with us, Earth life is the most complex life. And if there is life on Mars, or Europa, or Titan, or maybe Venus, life there would not be more complicated than simple, primitive, single-celled life.
No, I'm talking about in different universes.
Beyond our solar system. And bearing in mind the solar system is the only place we're going to be able to explore with our probes in the foreseeable future. But if we look out into the entire galaxy, and we can maybe spot planets orbiting other stars down our telescopes, maybe there's very Earth-like planets out there where evolution has had the opportunity to get beyond simple, primitive life and evolve complexity and maybe multicellular life, maybe animal life, maybe even intelligent life. But even though I'm an astrobiologist, even though I believe there's life out there, my gut, my default position is that all the life in the galaxy is simple, is bacteria or maybe simple animals, because we don't see any evidence that would cause us to believe there might be intelligent life out there. We haven't received any messages from intelligent civilizations.
Lewis, there's not much evidence that there's intelligent life here.
Well, this is true. So this Gandhi was once asked what he thought of Western civilization, and he quipped, he thought it'd be a good idea. And I think you could say the same about what do you think of life and intelligent life in the universe, and maybe you could ask whether we even have any on Earth. And as we've said before, we're facing some very big challenges at the moment in terms of how we're treating our planet. And even just from a selfish point of view, we've got to look after the atmosphere and the oceans, otherwise humanity will start suffering very, very soon. So I think humanity's about to face its test as to whether we really are intelligent or not.
Yeah, Lewis, your book is fascinating, and you are a true gentleman, and we're going to encourage everyone to go out and go pick up your book, and I'd like you to encourage everyone you know to listen to our interview so this way they could hear you and me speak.
I certainly will. Can I make one more mention? If
people yes, of course.
I found these ideas interesting. You can buy the book, but before you do that, if you want, you can have an explore through the book's website, which is the-knowledge.org, so the-knowledge.org. And there's loads of stuff you can read through, the extra material that didn't make it into the book. There's loads of how-to guides of things you can do by yourself at home. There's loads of videos you can watch that we recorded for the book publication. So there's loads of fun stuff you can explore there. And tell me your ideas. What would be the most important information and knowledge that you would try to preserve if the world were to come to an end?
I would want to be exactly on point zero so that whatever happened to me first. I think the thing that I would probably say, honestly, if the world were coming to an end, the realization that before we are Jews, Christians, or Muslims, we are human beings. And without the basic respect for human life and human opinion and the need for human integration of skills and knowledge, we cannot and will not survive, and will just cause another apocalypse.
Right tonight,
So that would be my last parting words, as I would be the first to go because I can't nail anything into the wall.
Maybe you'll learn quickly. You need to.
Thank you, Lewis. It was great talking to you.
Thanks ever so much. Cheers.
Bye now. Cheers. I want to once again thank Lewis Dartnell for coming onto our show. This is a very interesting show in terms of the fact that everyone has on their mind in this day and age what could possibly happen next. So go pick up a copy of his book, The Knowledge, on Amazon.com. And while you're there, visit his website at www.lewisdartnell.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Now, I'd love you to check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com. Keep listening and keep sending in your feedback. Till next time.